The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
We're into the second hour of the programme on this Thursday, the 26th of January. I do hope you're very well, and thank you so much for listening and getting involved in the conversation. And just a reminder for you listening on repeat or on podcast or overnight, you can text us with your comments anytime, 086 60 25000, and we can pick them up in the morning or when you send them, or your emails to comments@highlandradio.com. Will Cairdock now close at 12 midnight? I asked that question of our guest, and the answer there was no. If a doctor is on call in Malinhead, do they realise how long it will take to see an emergency patient in Falkara? It's only going to increase ambulance call outs, but according to our guest, that the service will actually improve, and that where it's located at the moment, that would maintain. Greg, when is the last time someone tried to book B&B in Donegal? I called for this weekend and could only get one night B&B for two people at €180. Some places would only let me book two nights at the weekend at €600 for two nights B&B for two people. In Dublin, two nights B&B is €1,400. How can tourists pay for that? Not going to lie, it's not my experience. I would use B&Bs. I would have more in the past, and I never had that problem. 70, 80 quid a night really was what I was paying in Letterkenny, and I've stayed in a few places. Unless things have drastically changed, I don't think that's B&B prices, though. I know, I think there's an expectation that B&B is slightly less than a hotel, isn't there? Those that seem very much like hotel prices. We, the parents of special need children in Inishowen, are still not getting information on why our children are still not in full time in Castle na Cor. Can you please ask what's happening? Thank you. Yes, we've put a question in to try and get an answer for you on that. Councillor Rena Donaghy says things are improving, not as good as we hoped, but we are hopeful that will change in the coming weeks. Some of 2 days back, some of 5 days. We understand parents are suffering burnout, and we're doing all we can to resolve the issue. So that's a comment from Councillor Rena Donaghy on those services. They're working on it. Back to now, Doc. How will Care Doc deal with triage any faster when they struggle to deal with what they already have? It would be different people doing it, is the impression I got. Potentially. Dr. Coyne seems to be the view that things will improve. What's your opinions on it now, though? I think maybe they're, as I say, I thought it was really worthwhile to get a conversation with Dr. Coyne. That's one side of it. We're hearing from other people's views. But, you know, in the early parts of this conversation, you know, a lot of people were very worried about what was to come. Are you assured or reassured or more optimistic about the future of the NowDoc service if it were to change? Get involved, 086 60 25000, or call 07491 25000. I just got my ESB bill and it's €500. It was a red bill, as all of them were. My last bill was 216. I was away for Christmas. Can anyone explain this huge increase? That is a huge increase. They weren't even at home at Christmas. It's gone from 216 to 500. It's not on usage because each bill has been read, and they weren't there in December, part of December at least. That's a big jump, isn't it? I dread getting mine. I really do. Hi, Greg. From the west, I'm from the west of the county, and young people are leaving in their droves. We'll soon not have a soccer team or a GEA team. Pubs and cafes will close. They believe the government doesn't care, as they have Pascal's job. It suits the government if they all leave. I'm sure that's not the case. Any government would need people here to contribute taxes and whatever, everything a population actually does. I think that's off the back of the comments I made yesterday, that every second post on social media seems to be young ones leaving. And as I say, I'm torn. I don't know if it's fantastic for them and they're doing it because they would anyway, and they just want to spread their wings and get life experience, or do they feel they have to? I don't know. To Highland Radio re-student student grants, both me, my husband work as nurses in the public service. Second child at college, just outside the threshold for the SUSE support. We've immediate family support with loans, etc. Credit unions have been a good support also for fees. Both children often offered subs from fellow students in receipt of SUSE, not under some same financial pressure as the rest of us. So that's two people working as nurses in the public sector, and they have a second child at college, having to borrow from family, credit union loans, just outside the SUSE support, which is terrible for them. And a lot of pressure as they're probably getting old. I mean, you're still very young, but maybe we have this unrealistic expectation that as you get into your 40s, 50s, that maybe things get a little bit easier. Certainly not. Homework conversation, just finishing up a few remarks on that as people took the time to text in. Homework should be no more than some light reading or just verbally discussing what they've learned at school that day. A lot of children just need to decompress after a day at school, no more than we do after a day at work. Then when it comes to homework time in the evening, it's just added stress and work most of the time for the whole family, especially if the kids play football or dance, etc., after school in the evenings. A lot of people saying the same story. I think what a lot of us go through or have gone through, lots and lots of us can relate to it, because it seems it's the same in every house. We spend hours on our children's homework, but it's never corrected. That really bugs me. I can understand that, yeah. And last one just for now on this, regarding the discussion about homework, I believe homework is important because it lets me see how my children are doing. We only see their teacher once a year. I know from seeing them actually doing the work, what they are struggling with, what they need extra help with. I can then make sure that they get the help if needed. If, as that lady says, it's causing conflict or tension, then maybe there's a bigger issue. I've seen firsthand major conflict with my niece and parents for years about homework. Turned out she had dyslexia. No teacher came to parents saying it might be a possibility. It was only because the parents struggled with doing homework with her. They knew something was wrong and pushed school for assistance. Okay, I actually partially read that email yesterday and I wanted to make sure to get it all out today. So apologies, you might have been frustrated if you only read the first part. There it is in its entirety. A caller says, in relation to Cashel Nacor, my child attends there. They love the routine and it's a place to meet their peers. The buzz in them rising on a centre day as opposed to a day at home is incredible. I do worry about their mental health. Surely routine should be back to normal by now and our children deserve better. Trust we will stay on that issue for you. All these people talking about Micah, but they never mentioned Joe McHugh. Is he even still a TD for Donegal? Well, Joe McHugh gave up the party whip, the Fine Gael party whip, on the issue outside of that. And he's also flagged his intention to resign outside of that. I'm not defending Joe McHugh's well able to look after himself, but what else would you like him to be doing? Has Dara O'Brien, the Minister of Housing, ever been speaking on Highland Radio? And if not, then why not? My heart goes out to all of those Micah people. The government has let Donegal down big time. Roll on the next election and we'll show them. Thanks for airing my views. It's our pleasure. He was on at the time of the announcement of the scheme and obviously defended the scheme. But, you know, people make the decisions when and when not to speak on the radio, and the public can make up their own minds in relation to that. We do continue to invite him, as we do regularly, ministers, and we've got very good access, thankfully, because I think most of them feel that they get a fair outing. Mark McCollums, a community campaigner, joins us on the programme now. Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning to you, Greg. Happy New Year.
And same to you. Same to you, Mark. Right, okay. You're speaking out on, I don't know, it's a frustration. It's beyond a frustration, I'm sure. It's something you wish you want to highlight.
Well, it's just that it's a new year. We're entering almost the second quarter of the 21st century, and we are in a very bad place. You know, we have a crumbling health service. We have an inadequate mental health service. We have crumbling houses. We have systems that are failing our people. And, you know, it has to change. It has to change. And you turn on I was listening to the radio this morning, and it's the number of posters or campaigns that politicians had in 2016 is sort of the first story. Because there's more important substantive issues that people should be dealing with.
I get
other
that,
than
but these
posters
are,
on a poll.
I understand that, and I don't dispute that, and I think it's time for people to move on. But these are the legislators, okay? And if we can't, if the legislators are not abiding by the rules, I think that's a very important indication then as to how they might be able to function in determining policy that addresses the very issues we're about to talk about now. So I think there should be a space to make sure that those that make the decisions and are very well rewarded to do so are doing so within the same kind of boundaries and guidelines that we're expected to live by.
Exactly. Well, I know there's standards and ethics, and we are they are governed by codes that are supposed to adhere to, but you know, we are where we are now because of the policies that have been implemented by the governments for successive over the years. And, you know, it's patently obvious that society has never been as unequal. The wealthy 10% are much, much more advanced than the vast majority of the ordinary people. And the disconnect between those making the decision, making the policy decisions, and those on the ground is seems to be wider than ever before. That, you know, that the politicians and the policymakers don't seem to be actually realizing what the impact that this is having for the average person.
Mm-hmm. But Mark, I think, and we'll tease it out, by the way, I'm not cutting across you, but I think, you know, you're not the first person to make these points, and other people have made these points and stood for election, but don't get elected. You know, the people, you end up with the politicians and the policies that you elect, though. So why is sort of your views then not resonating to the point where the electorate vote for change if it is the fault of successive governments? Maybe the majority of people who choose to vote believe that the government's doing a good job.
Well, maybe that's the case, but from my perspective, I don't think they are. I think their policies over the years, they have led to the housing crisis, have led to the health crisis, have led to our young people not being able to get accommodation for studies and having to emigrate because there's no chance of them ever owning a house. You know, this is the first generation now that's going to be probably even worse off than the generations before. And anybody who says that that's a good job being done by the government is delusional. You know, that they can wrap it up or spin it whatever way they like, but they're not delivering for the average person and the citizens of this country. Mm-hmm. There is a need for a change, you know. And it's a cross-party. I'm not aligned to any sort of political party or a convention, but it's just I see inequality, I see injustice, and just feel that, no, things have to change.
Mark, I don't want to be negative about what the future might hold, right? But I wonder, in how we do politics, really, can there be change? Because if you look to every other country in the world, seemingly pretty much every other country that we can relate to, I suppose, it's the exact same. They've had successive governments in different countries, in France, Germany, Britain to some extent. You know what I mean? The governments change in and out, different coalitions, different leadership. But every country in Europe, it seems, and America and other places, are suffering the same. Like, we've got loads of people heading to Australia, okay?
Yeah.
But in Australia, the population there, they've got 130,000 people homeless. They're struggling with immigration, the same kind of conversations, access to health, poor mental health services. Do you know what I mean? It's not like our young people are heading to a far-flung land where everything is... It might be better for them because they can get a room, work their socks off, accumulate some cash... But they're not heading to a utopia either. Do you know what I mean? So we need to be doing politics different wherever we are then, surely.
I think, you know, what we have to start with is, you know, we have to put people at the centre of it. You know, it isn't about party. It isn't about, you know, it has to be what policies are going to serve the vast majority of the people positively as opposed to serving an economy. And a country isn't an economy. We hear so much about the markets and about economy and how we have to continue growth. That sort of neoliberal politics is failing, and it's patently obvious it is failing. You're right, it's not just failing in Ireland, it's failing everywhere it's been implemented. But there are alternatives. Like, we look to Scandinavia, they've dealt with their homeless crisis. They've eradicated it. Their education systems is much better than ours. Their mental health services are more adequate and have much better results. So there are models of practice that we can look to and learn from, as opposed to just... The definition of madness is continually doing the thing that you're doing and expecting a different outcome. We're just implementing these policies over and over again, and expecting change to happen, and it's not going to happen unless there is is that radical shake-up, that there is sort of some radical thinking there that is going to shake up the complacency and shake up the apathy that people say, you know, there is this, sure, what can you do attitude, sure, you know, we're doing our best. It's not, we're not doing our best. We're not serving the people of Ireland. We're not serving, and we're failing our young people. We're failing our older people, you know, and the society can be judged on how it treats the most vulnerable people and its members. And at the minute, Irish society is not serving its most vulnerable people in any way adequately at all. You know, there was a report published on Monday on mental health services, and it just was abysmal that we are, the services for young people in this country are absolutely, you know, abysmal.
Non-existent in places.
It's really worth pointing out that
report on CAMHS was for 10% of the services,
you know, so. And we given the stresses now that people are under, and the, you know, the lack of opportunity, and the pressures that are people under, people are more likely to be suffering from anxiety and suffering from isolation, and they're more need of supports and services there, and they're not there. So this is just going to be a problem that isn't going to be just cured quickly. But if we look to other jurisdictions and other countries, they've dealt with the problems differently. Like they're doing work in Scandinavia and Switzerland that there's programs there called the Soteria models, non-medical interventions that have been running there since the 70s and 80s that they're not even on the radar over here. You know, there's not even talked about. But we could be using them. And why are we not providing the people of Ireland with these services?
Those services have to be paid for.
We're paying for services anyway.
If a government came in and said, right, I mean, obviously they'd have to equally tax the wealthy, but if they said everyone's going to have to pay a bit more because this is the services that yous want, would any government be elected in if that's what they proposed? Do you know what I mean? So I think it's almost it's self-defeating.
Well, no, I feel if the services were improved and if people could see an improvement in the services, can see improvement in the medical health system and can see the mental health system improve, they would acknowledge that, and they would be that they wouldn't be a rejection of paying an additional tax, because we're paying tax anyway, and we're not a poor country. We're investing vast amounts of money in our health system, but it's, you know, how is that investment and where is that investment going? You know, again, go back to, if you're just ploughing money into something that's not working in the first place, that's just, you know, it's not, that's deluded thinking, you know, mm-hmm. that's a failed policy. But if you can look at, okay, why is this not working? What can we do different? And how can we improve things? And there has to be that willingness to change, and there has to be a willingness to look at things, and how can we do things different? How can we improve our health system for the people? That we're not constantly hearing that there's the waiting times in hospitals, that the ADs are being overrun. You know, we've almost become complacent that we accept this now, that this is normal, and it shouldn't be normal. This should not be normalized.
Yeah.
You know, it shouldn't be normalized.
But we have to be careful too. I suppose you're using Switzerland as an example. It's been a while since I looked into, because, you know, there are certain countries that are listed as being, well, look what they do here. Like Switzerland has homelessness problem. It depends on where you live. It depends on your background. If you're in a French speaking part of Switzerland, there's a higher rate of homelessness. Just using that as one example. Yeah. Again, you know, I think when we're making comparisons, Mark, and I'm not calling you up on it, I'm on about myself as well, because I can be quick to this, is that we have to really dig deep and say, really, is it better over there? You know,
Well, there's facets of it. There's elements of what they're doing that could, you know, that we could incorporate.
Take the best of everywhere, then.
Looking at what's working in other areas that they're doing correctly and implementing them here. You know, and that's what, you know, there is no utopia. There is nowhere that's perfect. There is no, so we can just point to that and say, yeah, we can look at Scandinavia. Yes, they're taxed, they're good services, but yes, they pay a higher rate of tax for that. You know, but that's the trade-off. And again, we have this view in Ireland where we're constantly looking about establishing multinational companies over here. You know, there's a need for growth at community level, at community supports, and looking at where people are at. You know, people are not corporations. You know, we forget again that, and we sort of focus on the economy and we focus on growth and we focus on development. You know, that's not, and this sort of measure of GDP as a measure of success, you know, that it's, the measure of GDP isn't sustainable. You cannot have constant growth. If you have a sort of, you know, you have to have supports there for the people that are providing the growth.
It sounds to me like, I know where you're coming from, right? But it sounds to me like this world's not set up for us to live like we should. I mean, because, well, I mean, obviously, we there are certain rules in terms of taxation that we have to abide by within the EU. I mean, we have to ask the EU permission to lower VAT rates on diesel at times. Don't get me wrong. Like, I understand, like, people say, right, let's get out in the street, enough is enough, you know, let's stand together, let's change things, right? But who's going to change them? I don't think the current government can be compelled to do so. I don't think Sinn Féin, for example, will promise what you want at the next election. So in terms of how people can affect change, right, the type of change that you want if they agree with you, who do they vote for? Like, who do you vote for? Because the promises that you want will not even be, sorry, that what you want won't even be promised at the next general election.
Yeah,
so
I know.
What are we standing up for? What are we uniting for? What are we showing solidarity for? Because I think sometimes maybe just doing that is occupying our minds, but not actually taking away from the reality that who delivers this change? Because the real decisions we can make are at the ballot box. But who do you vote for?
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. We have the illusion of democracy. We have the illusion of choice that we can affect change. When the reality is, it is that we don't have our ballot isn't as powerful as we would like to think it is, and it's a flawed system, and we are presented with two or three options with whatever party is going to promise and commit to delivering on whatever policies they come up with, and that's. But I think what should be happening is that the parties would need to be listening more to the people and serving the people as opposed to serving their own political agendas and party agendas. And this sort of emanated and sort of has roots back in the sort of mid-80s with the neoliberal agenda in terms of the capitalist economic growth being the barometer for success of a country, and not how it treats its people, and not how it treats and treating people as economic units as contributing to that society. Mm-hmm. We need to get back to a situation where we were treating people fairly. We had an equitable society. We had, you know, that people could have an idea of having an adequate living, aspiration to have a house, aspiration to have a job. You know, nothing grandiose, just to have a life that was going to be
But was our expectation, say, in the 80s or 70s, did we expect everything that we expect now? Like, maybe having the house was enough for us, but now we want services to our front door, we want the best of roads, we want a rail service, we want to have a certain standard of life, we want to have a certain standard of healthcare. Do you know what I'm... Like, I'm saying that those are very sound aspirations, don't get me wrong, but are you... What pleased us in the 80s and 90s and what could be delivered, would that please us now? Would that be enough?
But I think the difference was when we in the 80s, when they sort of came in with the neoliberal politics, and it became more about privatization and about profit, and about it ceased to be about more about supporting people and supporting services, and that became more about Ireland became more about an economy, and the UK became about an economy as opposed to a state that looked after its people. And looked after cradle to grave, you know, looked after the youngest, the oldest, the most vulnerable, disabled people, that we don't have the situation now where we have the queues at hospitals, that we have a failed mental health servant. You know, this is the fruit of that neoliberal politics.
Let's not forget, though, our attitude back in the days that you talk of to someone if they got pregnant, or how we called them lunatic asylums. You know what I'm on about? Like, you look back as
if... I'm not trying to
cut the legs from under you on this either, but, I mean, there was an awful lot went on that you couldn't even discuss. Now, whether that's... things are better now because we can discuss it or not, I don't know, but there's always been the downtrodden. There's always been the lesser. You know, there's always been the lords and the peasants. Do you know what I mean? Historically, I don't know how. I think we do it in a different way now. But really, are things any different now than they were 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 150 years ago?
It has shifted, and society. You're right. Society has become less equal and more divided than any other time. Like the gap between those who are the running the companies and running the organisations and the average person who's delivering healthcare or delivering mental work has never been wider. You know, and there is this. Why did we end up here? How did we end up here? But it's the implementation of these successive government policies that have led us to this point. You know, this, as I said before, this is almost the second quarter of the 21st century, and we are. This wasn't in the script, or it shouldn't have been in the script for us. We should be now in a situation where we have security in how our older people are going to be cared for, security in how our disabled people are going to be looked after, but. You know, what has gone wrong? But all I see is that the successive governments failing people and promising to alleviate change and affect change, and nothing happens.
But the majority, do you think the majority, like, you can't, I don't think anyone should be left behind, don't get me wrong, but the majority of people that, say, for instance, go through the health service might say, the surveys would suggest that they have a very positive experience. You know, there are way more people accessing mental health services than are unable to access them. Even when we talk about the school transport every year, you know, 95% of people are satisfied with it, but 5% are not. But I'm not saying this as a defence, or it's just to tease out the conversation. Are things for the majority of society as bad as you're outlining them? Lots of people have lovely new cars. Lots of people are in big houses. Lots of people are going on holidays. Look at Dublin Airport. It's chock-a-block. Do you know, like...
But by the same token, there is a significant proportion of people who are feeling abjectly. You know, it's not just people are in the margins. There are a lot of people. We have over 10,000 people who are homeless. You know, that's an indictment to any government policy we have. As we have here, we have homes that are falling down and crumbling.
That is an absolute disgrace. And again, I'm only saying this stuff to try and have the conversation, Mark. Right? We have a population in the Republic of Ireland of in excess of 5 million. Obviously, when you have a homeless problem, there's a certain amount of them. It's not like just giving them accommodation. They need wraparound supports as well, because there could be other issues there. It's completely unacceptable that there is that level of homelessness, right? But how does that rank in international terms? You know, like, if we were, there shouldn't be 10,000, but when you have a population, is there an inevitability going to be a level of homelessness? As I say, please, I don't want listeners to think that I'm in any way saying anything is okay, but it's just, Mark, you understand, I hope. I'm just trying to make sure that people who feel that things aren't that bad feel their voice is getting heard. Does that make sense?
Yeah, we are. As I said before, we are a wealthy country. We are a wealthy economy, and we have been successful in that terms. But the same token, there's a lot of people being left behind.
Yeah,
and that's the sort of that gap between those who, there's almost as if it's only some people in individualization. If somebody is failing or somebody is home, it's somehow down to their fault that they're not, they've failed, they're not working hard enough, they're not contributing. Whereas the structures within society itself are geared up so that large sections of society cannot function in that way without additional supports. But it's this individualization of blame that somehow if you work hard enough and you drive away, you can be successful. You know, that again is illusionary. You know, that a lot of times that's not the case. No matter how hard you work, or some of the hardest working people I know are struggling.
But I think most people are actually just working to survive. They're working to tick along.
It's been like being on a hamster wheel. You're just spinning, you know.
But maybe that's life. I don't know. Maybe that is life. What else can we expect?
That's quite. Well,
so, Mark, listen, just in the last minute or two then, in reality, though, how is change affected? Because you're not talking about voting for opposition parties here because they're not promising what you are looking for. So voting independent is what...
Well, I think people have to have their voices heard. You know, tell the politicians what they want. They want improved health service. They want, and they, you know, that so the politicians are being guided by the people. So it's not just that the politicians are saying, instead of going away for a thinking over a weekend and coming up with some policies and saying, here's, take it or leave it. They have to listen to the people. I think that's what's missing from politics, that the voices of the people that need to be heard aren't being listened to in terms of looking for improvements, looking for making the quality of life for the citizens of the country, not just for some, but for everyone, making it better for everyone.
All right, Mark, this is an interesting conversation, and it starts a conversation. Cheers, interested to hear what people have to say. I'm not saying I disagree with you. I'm just trying to, you know, widen out a little bit because, we do say, you know, rise up or wake up, but fundamentally, what does it actually mean? Do you know what I mean? And that's kind of what I was trying to tease along with you. It's not a criticism in any way, shape or form. I hope you know that. It's just to progress it, maybe a bit. All right, Mark, lovely to chat to you. Take care of yourself. Mark McCollum there, community campaigner. We're joined on the programme now by Dr. John Donoghue, Senior Clinical Psychologist with Donegal Cancer Support Centre. Good morning to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks ever so much, Greg. Really appreciate your time to speak with you this morning.
No, it's an important thing that's coming up. Living with Uncertainty webinar is taking place on Tuesday, the 31st of January, and it's focusing on learning how to live well after a cancer diagnosis. I presume people who've received that diagnosis or someone close to them, you know, have an understanding retrospectively, but people are getting this news all the time. And I suppose, how are we equipped to deal with that?
I think that it's worth saying that it's actually surprising to a lot of people that the difficulties arise for people, particularly psychologically, really in the aftermath of treatment. Because when people are being overseen by their doctors, by their nurses, it's almost like they have a wraparound around them, and they're going through their treatment and they're developing a kind of a routine. And that's actually quite a stabilizing feature psychologically.
There's also sometimes an element of camaraderie because they might find themselves, their treatment coinciding with other people's treatment, or they might travel to treatment with other people, and there's a support, a little bit of a support bubble there.
When they're in the chemotherapy suite, they're often seeing the same people round about the same time over the course of maybe two or three week cycles. So absolutely, they do develop a relationship with people who are going through very similar sets of circumstances. And of course, they'll develop relationships with the staff there at the hospital as well. They'll see the same people. They'll receive generally the same treatment, during the course of their sort of treatment cycle. But of course, that has a certain finite amount of time, and that generally comes to an end. And as part of the World Day of Cancer, which is the 4th of February, Cancer Care West have kind of put together, it's the second of two webinars. The first was held just before Christmas, and now we have our second one coming up, as you say, on the 31st. And this actually is really concentrating on what happens after treatment. So that's why we call it living with uncertainty and learning how to live well again after a cancer diagnosis.
And there's that, it all depends on people's outcomes, and I don't want to give examples in case it's upsetting to people, but even if someone is told that their cancer is in remission, then, you know, how soon after that uplift that you might receive, do you start worrying about, well, when's it going to come back? Is it going to pop up elsewhere? Or do you know what I mean? I don't know how long that window is where, or maybe it's immediate, where those thoughts might start to dominate. And I think as well, too, if maybe you're predisposed to something like anxiety, it's going to be much more difficult potentially for someone like that with recurring sort of circular thoughts and what have you. So you'll tool people up as best as you can, I suppose.
That's exactly it, and I think you're right, Greg, because there are some people who are naturally going to be predisposed to anxiety. Not all of us kind of tolerate uncertainty well. Some of us actually kind of get really rattled by not knowing the sort of the road ahead. And for those people, the uncertainty of what might happen, it really can begin to get under their skin. Just to kind of talk statistics, I suppose, just briefly,
yeah.
Anywhere between 25 and 75% of people in the aftermath of treatment will experience what's called fear of recurrence, which is a very well known phenomenon. And sometimes that fear can escalate into you know, day-to-day debilitating. It's in about 7%, but maybe about 7 to 10% of people will really find that they're really affected by anxiety.
But they want someone like you, doctor, to say it's not coming back. They would like you to be able to say it's not coming back, or they'd want you to give an exact percentage, or they'd want to give you an exact time frame. In the world of medicine, maybe it was different in the past, but certainly now that's not possible. So how can you help people to manage that uncertainty without raising or lowering expectations, for example?
Well, there's two ways. There's essentially this kind of what we call psychoeducation. So that would be giving people a framework to understand mind. Now, mind is a complicated thing, but it has an element of biology, and it has an element of psychology. So we would kind of one of the things in the webinar which will be talked about is we'll be talking about ACT, and ACT is a psychological therapy which has part of it a sort of an explanation of how our mind works in terms of response to threat. So when we're threatened, what gets activated neurobiologically? And when people have an understanding of that, they can kind of understand why the alarm bells are kind of going off in their mind really radically. And then, so that's the psychoeducation bit. The second bit will be the actual kind of techniques. Now, I won't get into kind of too much of that here, but in the webinar, we'll be talking a little bit more about various techniques that people can use and begin to habitualize. The key area in those techniques is practice. We're trying to kind of tone down the alarm bells so that actually they don't get to be the in the driving seat as much, and actually increase capacity to kind of live.
Proportionate, isn't it? I mean, you can't eliminate a fear of cancer research, but you have to put it into context and allow space for living within, you know, around that.
It's worth saying as well, it's unwise to turn the alarm bells off.
Yeah.
Just like it would be unwise to kind of turn the alarm off on your car and leave it outside wherever overnight. We want a certain amount of vigilance to be present. But we don't want that vigilance to be so activated that you're sort of paralyzed completely. Mm. So it's getting that kind of balance correct.
Okay.
And also orientated towards kind of living as well as you possibly can moving forward.
You have a couple of speakers, amongst them Dr. Katie Barrett, a psychologist, and Mary Kate Kelly, a counsellor.
Yes,
you know, this tried and tested. This is tried and tested. You know what I mean? Like the tools that will be discussed, the conversations they are proven to help people. And that's why, you know, you've brought these guests together for this webinar. Now, it is Tuesday, the 31st of January from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. It's via Zoom. So we're going to give people a number we're going to retain the number here. But to sign up, because you have to get an invite to the Zoom call, 07496 01 901. You can also sign up via social media links. Go to Cancer Care West. Will it be replayed after the fact as well, if the times don't suit John or?
Yeah, what we're doing is because of confidentiality, what we do is we record the presentations. So it runs over about an hour.
Mm-hmm.
There's about 20-25 minutes per. So Katie will speak for the first 25 minutes, then Mary Kate will speak, or vice versa, depending. And then that part of the presentation will be recorded. So, and the question in our answer bit, that's actually, a lot of people will be asking questions, obviously. So we don't record that bit for the cases of confidential.
And if it's okay, John, I'm sure if they're invited, I think this might be, sorry, there's a slight delay here. Of course, you're going to cut out the bit that could identify people after the fact, I understand. But I just want, I think this would be very important for people around people who've had a diagnosis. John, can you hear me okay there? No, the signal's gone to pot.
It's kind of jumping up. It's jumping around a bit, unfortunately.
Yeah. No, what I was just asking you is, this is open to for people around people who've had a diagnosis as well, that they can help them, presumably, is it? Is that okay?
Well, I think that's... can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I think it's worth saying that people around the patient, loved ones particularly, can really experience anxiety as well. In fact, some of the research would say that whilst low mood would sort of dissipate, anxiety in loved ones can remain and escalate over time. So really, it's actually something that loved ones could be. We would really welcome their participation as well, because they too will be able to use the techniques as well and get some understanding as well that actually, you know, they're in this as often as much as as the patient themselves.
Yeah, and then people I get you. Listen, the connection's not great, but we really appreciate your time. People can go to Donegal Cancer Support Centre and their social medias for more info. Thanks very much, John. Have a lovely day, will you? Take care of yourself. Thank you so much. The message came across clear, albeit a little bit stuttered at times.